Hello again, fellow travellers, and welcome to podcast 189 in our series, You Should Have Been There, with me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb. And today we're talking about the dark side of travel, in two very different ways. One of them decidedly grim, and the other one more dim, but I gather very uplifting.
Yes, it was absolutely beautiful. I really loved it. I was afraid that the clouds were going to come too much, but we could see the corona. It was really spectacular.
That was an astrophysicist, Jonathan Gagné, just minutes after the total solar eclipse, where it put on its full performance at a big city only in Montreal, Canada. Very exciting.
Montreal, Canada. And are you still there?
No, I'm not. And as you will probably hear during the podcast, I'm actually at an airport, specifically John F. Kennedy International in New York, which I thought couldn't possibly be as bad as I remembered it had been before COVID. But in fact, it is now even worse. An utter shambles. The security process is as though it's only just...
Well, the announcements seem to be very very good and very audible, I might say.
Yes, and I hope they're not interrupting too much. Yes, they're in the middle of a $19 billion improvement program, which says JFK can take you places. The 1990s will no longer be one of them. But frankly, if I were still in the 1990s, I would have a much better experience than I am now. Absolute shambles. But at least we now know that it is the worst airport in the world and our search is over. But of course, we're always delighted to hear from listeners about their nominations for the worst airport in the world. You can tweet us at YouShouldHaveBT or go to anchor.fm/YouShouldHaveBeenThere and leave an audio message.
Well, let's hear some thoughts of listeners on the apparently, maybe surprisingly contentious topic of staycations.
Yes, this term was coined officially, I think, 80 years ago. Yes, the
really?
Cincinnati Inquirer told citizens, this was during the war, 1944, they said, take a staycation, not a vacation. And it's always in its initial form meant staying at home, going off on little day trips, exploring the local area, something which would obviously be environmentally sound as well as a money-saving thing. But the trouble is, travel organisations, and I'm sorry to say journalists in the UK, began to use staycation as a shorthand for a domestic holiday, one in your own nation. And Visit England, would you believe, is in on the act. They've got lots of research material in which they continuously use staycation to mean a domestic trip with an overnight stay. But I conducted a poll. Nearly 11,000 people responded, and there was a very solid majority, 3-2, saying, no, it means you're staying at home and you're going off on day trips. Our friend Rebecca, she said that the term wrongly implies they're not proper holidays if you're not going abroad. And I think a lot of people would think the same. Alice Olsen says, I live in Leeds. If I travel to Cornwall, I've most definitely not staycationed. I've gone on holiday. But I did find one person, Prue Gowdy, who said that it was a domestic holiday with an overnight stay. She said, stay at home and day trip is a daycation, in my view. So bringing in yet another term, I'm afraid. And I'm afraid daycation is now banned, along with graycation for a holiday involving older travellers, naycation for a naturist holiday, and altercation, which I'm defining as a holiday that's easy to change.
Could I suggest laycation? I won't go into it in any more detail.
You certainly can do. I'm going to come back with vaccination, which is actually from the COVID time when you had to have proof of being jabbed to get exemption from travel restrictions. So, or indeed amplification, which is a holiday at a particularly noisy festival.
Well, when I was young, our family always had staycations in which we travelled from our home to the south coast, to the seaside, on 3 or 4 separate days sometimes over the course of the couple of weeks that my dad had off on holiday. So I think we might have been early adopters there. We certainly didn't call it staycation then.
Quite right too. But of course, if you are lucky enough to be living in Coolsden on the A23 south of London, then why would you frankly ever want to go anywhere else? I should point out, listeners, that Mick is now living in Streatham, which is also in the on the A23 south of London. And I was born by the A23. And of course, you can find our legendary A23 podcast, along with all the others that you might have missed.
Well, let's get on to dark travel and the journey that you've been on in order to see, although actually not to be able to see anything.
It was quite an adventure, not least because I was wanting to catch the Great American Eclipse 2024. I had a couple of possible target areas. I actually was hoping I would be in Niagara Falls, where the US and Canada meet, because the eclipse was due to go right over the top, and that would be an amazing experience in a very, very scenic location. I was also looking at Texas, the Midwest, but in the end, and I didn't book my flight until the morning before the eclipse because I wanted to get the latest weather forecast, the only big city that it was going to get a clear view that you could fly to from the UK was Montreal. I literally bagged the last seat on the British Airways Eclipse Express, as I shall call it. We chased the sunset all the way to Montreal. Then next day, I got up and really it was party time. Montreal was suddenly, unexpectedly in the limelight for seeing the light go out. And I talked to Rebecca Solomon, weather reporter for Meteo Media, who was on her first assignment to cover a total solar eclipse. Rebecca Solomon, tell me how you are feeling about right now.
Let me tell you, we're super excited. The weather is perfect today. I mean, it's almost summer temperatures and no sky is also blocking the sun. That was a big stress. A lot of us didn't sleep a couple of days before because we were like, oh my gosh, what if there's clouds in front of the sun? But it's a perfect day. Everybody's so cheerful. And it's my first time to see a total solar eclipse. So I'm excited to be amazed by the sun, by the sky, because we could see some planets. Then the temperatures could drop. And maybe the birds will stop singing. So there's all kinds of things. So it's exciting.
It's a little bit of high cloud. Is that a worry?
It is always a worry. But I think we're close to the moment of totality. So it should be okay.
I am a few seconds away from witnessing the greatest show on earth. The Great American Eclipse of 2026 is at its greatest here. You can see the sun disappear. I can, for the first time, look directly into the sun. A tiny fraction of humanity has ever witnessed a total eclipse. I can just see the black disk of the moon, which is obscuring the sun perfectly. There is still light leaking from the sun, and you can see dazzling diamonds. That's actually coming through, would you believe, the lunar valleys.
Well, that all sounds very exciting, Simon, but my first question is, have you added time travel to your other travelling skills and attributes?
No, I haven't. I was obviously overexcited, as they say, and I was looking ahead. Actually, this is a good point, to the next great solar eclipse, which is going to be much easier to see. If you happen to live in the UK, because you only need to go to Spain. It's going to sweep down on the 12th of August. Yes, lots of us will be on holiday there or maybe on staycation already. And it will go
that's
across
2026,
Greenland, Iceland,
we should.
But more importantly, yeah, 2026. Yes, exactly. It will go ashore, I think, in Bilbao, sweep across Zaragoza, all the way over to the beautiful Balearic island of Mallorca.
How fast would you have to be travelling to actually follow it, if you see what I mean, all the way?
The eclipse tends to go at 1,500 miles an hour, which is faster than you or I can cycle. And it was actually tracked across part of the US by supersonic fighter pilots. They've been told to. It wasn't something they decided to do.
Oh, blimey, is that your one? London Heathrow. Is that your flight, Simon?
It is, it is.
Oh, crikey, we better crack on, hadn't we?
Yes.
We can't really stop for this, but do tell me more. Did the birds actually stop singing and the temperature drop? And is it pitch black?
Okay, first of all, the birds might have stopped singing, but the humans were making such a racket that you literally couldn't tell.
Yeah.
The temperature very, very much came down, and there was only 90 seconds of totality because Montreal was quite close to the edge of the zone of totality. However, those 90 seconds were absolutely magical. And the great thing was that it's not completely dark. There's still the corona of the sun, but there is such a difference between 99% obscuring of the sun and 100%, as we've previously heard from Dr. John Mason, the eclipse guru, that it was so spectacular. It was definitely cold, although there was snow on the ground. This is Montreal in April, so it was definitely cold. But the amazing experience of looking across to the west, where it looked as though dawn was breaking, because this was outside of the zone of totality. So you actually had dawn apparently breaking on the wrong side of the world.
How exciting. And who were your fellow spotters? Well, I mean, there's certainly lots of them from the sound.
Yes, there were probably half a dozen of us at the gate at Terminal 5 at Heathrow on the way out. We identified each other as eclipse chasers. But actually, the vast majority of this crowd of 200,000 people, perhaps, in a park in Montreal, were just local people who couldn't believe their good fortune. Among them, an astrophysicist who works for Montreal Planetarium, Jonathan Gagne.
It was absolutely beautiful. I really loved it. I was afraid that the clouds were going to come too much, but we could see the corona. It was really spectacular.
What is it, from an astrophysicist's point of view, that you are looking for?
So, to be honest, I'm looking at amazement at the beauty of nature. When I look at a total solar eclipse, it's just completely mind-bending how beautiful it is. So I'm just taking the moment in with my own eyes to really see the beauty of nature.
So even though there are some incredibly good, expensive cameras here, you prefer just to use the naked eye?
During the totality, yes, because I like to feel the connection with what is happening right now. And it's so rare in astronomy that we can actually see something with our own eyes, so I just fully enjoy that moment.
Do you think this will encourage more people to get an interest in astronomy and astrophysics?
I suspect it will. For me, it really left a mark, especially when I saw the first one in 2017 in the US, and those are the moments I will remember all my life. So I wouldn't be surprised if it motivated a lot of people to care about space.
And what was the single moment that you will remember the most from this?
I think it's holding my daughters while looking at the eclipse and seeing like their amazement in their eyes as well as mine. I think that's a moment I'll remember.
Well, that was Jonathan Gagne, appropriately enough an astrophysicist. But Simon, what's the moment that you will remember most of that particular eclipse? And I suppose, how does it rate in your eclipse archive?
You've got 90 seconds where it goes completely dark, and then suddenly the sign that the sun is coming back to life is this just this tiny diamond ring, which gets brighter and brighter on the edge of the moon's shadow. And that signifies that things are coming back to life, and it's apparently going through a lunar valley, and that's how you get to see it. That was so exciting. And just being among the crowd, I've been to a couple of eclipses before, one on a ranch, one in an ancient fortress, with merely a group of 100 or so eclipse spotters. But just to get the great crowd sounds was marvelous. So it was the sound of humanity being awestruck. I was absolutely thrilled to be there. And I'll also remember just how jolly all the Montrealers were and how it was like chucking out time at the O2. They've only got one underground station. Everybody was just in such a good mood. No security, no worries. Everybody helped each other. So, yes, the Canadians deserved it and they got a great one. But, Mick, how far will you go to see an eclipse? And have you actually ever seen one?
I think I have actually, as a child, and I'm sure it was very exciting. I do remember being told not to look at the sun, and I think we had, I think my mother gave us kids old film negative to look through, yeah. Something like that. It was it. So I the trouble is I can't remember exactly when, and I don't think it was a full eclipse, but probably it was in sunny and then for a second sunless Causton. I probably wouldn't go that far to see one, quite honestly. I'd go further to see the Perseids meteor shower in August, because it's nice and warm and there is nothing quite like lying on the grass on a very almost tropical night in southern France, in the countryside, of course, and spotting shooting stars.
Okay, well, if you're prepared to get a rather colder experience, Dr. John Mason had hinted to me in a message that the Northern Lights are going to be at their absolute best for the next two winters. We should get him back on and he can tell us all about the Northern Lights. So, honestly, the difference between a partial eclipse, which you would have seen, and listeners, do not use an old bit of exposed film for this. You've got to have proper eclipse glasses if you're viewing a partial eclipse, and they obscure something like 99.99% of all sunlight. So make sure that you are properly equipped before you look up at the sun.
Right. Well, let's move on to our other dark topic. And this one is morally dark rather than physically dark. It was something that we started talking about after your recent visit to the ITB. That's the huge travel show in Berlin.
Yes, this is an occasion where every country in the world says, come to our wonderful location and you will have the time of your life, and get here as soon as possible, is the general message, except from one stand. This was the Ukrainian representatives. It's the first time they've been since the Russian invasion at a big tourism event saying, come to Ukraine. But the message very much is, not yet. Mariana Oleskiv, you have launched Ukraine as a tourist destination here at ITB today. Can you tell me how the response has been?
It's very, very good response. And we remind the world that Ukraine is here in the center of Europe, fighting for freedom and democracy still. And the brave hearts of Ukraine, also from tourism industry, are there at the front line. Even though they wanted to travel around the country, around the world, they are traveling the roads of war, unfortunately. And we are here to make sure that after they will be back from the front line, from being there to defend our country, there will be tourism in Ukraine waiting for them, to provide them possibilities to develop and to welcome international visitors. So we are getting ready. We have, we meet partners, we sign MOUs to be ready to restart tourism as soon as it will be possible.
It's just very strange because everywhere else here, I'm looking around, there's Ireland, there's Estonia. I could go there tomorrow on vacation, but I can't go to Ukraine. That must make it very difficult for you.
It is difficult, but we see people, you know, just taking pictures, just passing by and seeing Ukraine is here, taking pictures. So it's important reminder, and it's important that ITB also gives us this possibility, even though we are not the destination that invites now, and but that we are a destination that reminds about us and that we are still here waiting for the right moment, waiting for the time, waiting for our victory.
Well, that was Mariana Oleksiv, and her description of Ukrainian employees, I suppose, in the travel industry now traveling the roads of war were certainly very powerful ones. But I wanted to ask you, Simon, how you think that Ukraine's tourism will possibly be able to recover, or indeed take a stab at how long it might take. I mean, can travel and tourism really be a priority?
It will be once there is some sort of peace deal, and it will, as we have seen in other parts of the world, be a really important feature of the rebuilding, because an awful lot of people want to do something in order to help Ukraine. And of course, there will be tens, hundreds of billions of pounds going into the physical rebuilding. But actually, the Ukrainians, if they follow the same sort of pattern as other countries which have been victims of terrible wars, will want people to come back quickly and bring in wealth and create jobs. And tourism does all of that. So it will be a really important aspect. Ukraine wasn't huge for tourism before the Russian invasion. Of course, the Russians had, as it were, already purloined since 2014 the jewel in the tourism crown of Ukraine, which is the Crimea, and in particular the beaches in resorts such as Yalta. So the rest of Ukraine, it was basically...
Good morning, in the terminal, this is service final boarding call, final boarding opportunity for all confirmed customers.
That's not your one, is it, Simon?
No, it's not, I'm glad to say. I'm actually perched by the gate, so I will, if I suddenly have to leave you, which I would hate to do, Mick, I will... They can drag me on board from here once I've dismantled the studio which I've set up, which I've had a couple of curious looks about anyway.
Well, we should get back to Ukraine. Who on earth will go there other than journalists, of course?
Well, there will be a number of people who will want to go and see the places that have been devastated. That, for me, is not an appeal, but there are people who wish to go and have a look at the effects of war. And we saw that, for example, in Serbia, in Belgrade in particular, at the end of the Yugoslav Civil War. People, I guess, find it interesting to go and see the places that they've been reading about in the newspapers. But beyond that, I hope people will actually think, well, we've read about Kyiv. It's an interesting city, evidently. Let's go and enjoy a weekend there, which you can do very happily. And in particular, the other two great tourism cities of Ukraine, Lviv and Odessa, are probably even more rewarding and probably even less affected. So people who just want to go and show willing and also find an interesting city with hopefully people who will be delighted to welcome them and say, yeah, thanks for supporting us.
Yes, I think there is a fairly small sub-branch of tourism called dark tourism. There's certainly an interesting website, which I think is run by someone called Peter Hohenhaus, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. Peter, if you're listening to this, do please get in touch, because it is an interesting website, and it does actually, first of all, describe lots of dark destinations, the sort that you would know about. You mentioned Belgrade, for example, and obviously World War II concentration camps and Hiroshima, and I mean all kinds of places. But it does actually have a darkometer, which gives ratings to places depending on how dark they actually are. Looking at this reminded me that I met somebody at a theatrical event, actually, who told me that her father was part of a small group of friends who for years had been going every year to visit a new dark destination. And I wondered, is this healthy, do you think?
I think it's always been the case that, to some extent, tourism equals tragedy plus time. And certainly, I think if you look at somewhere like Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp, which is part of the genocide of the Holocaust, then that a lot of people who go to the beautiful city of Krakow will add on a day there. And I think that's a very valid thing to do. Looking at other places, I guess somewhere like Alcatraz, a prison in the middle of San Francisco Bay on an island, people perhaps would say that that's not a place of tragedy. I don't think many people make visiting dark sites the main purpose of their visit. It simply is a sad reflection of humanity that a lot of places that you go to will have some aspect of dark tourism.
Well, there are plenty of places around the world that are now exploiting, in the best possible sense of the word, the more tragic side of their history. I mean, Belgrade is very interesting, kind of reminders of the NATO bombings of the 1990s. And, I mean, Oradour sur Glane, a village that was devastated by the Nazis in the Second World War, has been actually preserved sort of in aspic. And I must say that is an incredibly powerful reminder. There's Ground Zero, there's the Berlin Holocaust Memorial.
I'll add to that list Northern Ireland, where in both Belfast, the capital, and the second city, Derry, Londonderry, you will find plenty of tours organised by people who were perhaps themselves involved in the troubles and the tragedies that unfolded from it. And then, of course, there is, going back to Ukraine, Chernobyl. We actually made a podcast about the place, and this perhaps will remind you of what it's like to go on tour in a place of nuclear disaster. Tell me, you're a long way from home, aren't you?
We are.
And what brought you here to Chernobyl?
We always wanted to visit Kiev. We missed an opportunity back in 1985, and our younger son visited Chernobyl in 2016. So as we recently retired, we decided to try and see as much of Europe as we can, and this was on our list. So it's been a really good tour.
Oh, it's been interesting. It's certainly been interesting. Yeah. Kiev's a great city, but this is an added bonus to it.
Do you think there's something slightly sinister, maybe morally wrong?
Macabre?
Macabre about coming to see a place like this?
Not if it's cleaned up.
No, we watched a documentary on them covering the...
With the sarcophagus
and building it and putting it on and how they did it, which was absolutely fascinating. So it's nice to see that in the flesh, so to speak, having watched a documentary.
Charlie Smith, tell me what you make of the Chernobyl experience.
The Chernobyl experience is breathtaking. It's surreal. It's dark and creepy at times. It's got a lot of eerie feelings, and it's quite paranormal.
Well, that was Chernobyl, obviously before the current and sadly ongoing Ukrainian disaster.
Yeah, I spoke to Mariana Oleskiv about this, and she said that Chernobyl will certainly not be opening up as a tourist destination initially, not least because there's so many mines there as a result of the Russian invasion. But we're delighted to hear from listeners about their views on dark tourism. Is it something that you indulge in? Do you think that it's morally questionable? Whatever your view, we'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us at youshouldhavebt or leave us an audio message at anchor.fm/youshouldhavebeenthere.
And that's all from today from me, Mick Webb.
And me, Simon Calder, here at JFK Airport, where, yes, the flight is already boarding. Talk to you next time, and thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The board flight 1107 with service to London Heathrow, departing here at gate number 23. Once again, please have your passports open to the picture page.